This week on Art in the Air features the new publisher of the Chesterton Tribune, Don Hurd, sharing his storied career saving local newspapers. Next, Lebesnik Center's exhibition director, Laura Fosberg, discusses her art and the new exhibit opening June 14th, featuring our talk with Chicago artist Phyllis Bramson. Our spotlight is with Chicago Street Theater director Michael Glorioso, discussing the June 11th opening of Heathers, the musical.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from Chicago Street Theater about their upcoming musical called Heathers, the musical, running June 11th through the 27th. And to talk about it, we have Michael Glorioso, who's the director of that. He's going to tell us a little bit about who they have, what they have, and when it is. Michael, welcome to Art on the Air.
Aloha, welcome.
Hi. Hello, thank you very much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about Heathers and why you chose it for Chicago Street Theater. It's probably not as familiar with a lot of people in terms of a musical, but yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Heathers kind of falls into the line of a lot of the shows that I've directed in the past. I tend to like to do those shows that were originally movies and then they get adapted to the stage. I've done Legally Blonde, you know, Evil Dead, things like that, Night of the Living Dead. But Heathers kind of really translated well to the stage, which is surprising because of how dark the content is in the original movie. But they take the dark content and make it really light, as well as you know, covering some of those really hard-hitting things of being bullied and teen suicide and things like that, and really kind of put a lightness to it, but still taking it very seriously. And that's what Chicago Street is kind of known for. Chicago Street really pushes the bar on a lot of these different shows. In years past, we've done Curious Incident of, and then also Keely and Dew and things like that. And Heathers kind of really translate to our stage very well with the subject matter and also the fun-loving comedy of it as well.
You know, it's a very musical-heavy show. You have 30 songs in it, which is kind of a lot for a musical. So is that a kind of a daunting task, putting 30 musical songs together?
Yeah, but a lot of it is with this author, the person who wrote the book, Lawrence O'Keefe, he tends to have a lot of songs that are long. So it's the opening number is about 10 minutes long, 9 to 10 minutes long. So a lot of that is just trying to get it up on its feet and getting all the motions going. It's a daunting task, but a lot of the musical numbers are a little bit shorter as well. So we have the long ones that are about 10 minutes, then we have the ones that are about 30 seconds. So although it says 30 musical pieces, it's more like maybe 15 to 20 if you count them all as actual full musical numbers as like 3 minutes, 2 minutes long.
So can you tell us about the theater? So what are going to be the protocols to see this? What kind of capacity do you have?
Well, we are very fortunate to be able to open up to full capacity. Our house seats about 130 people, 125 people, and there will be a mask mandate for everyone that's in the audience, which is going to be mandatory for if you want to come in, and also the general rules of if you don't feel well, please don't show up. We will be issuing refunds if that's the case. If, you know, if you have to buy tickets and then have to relinquish those tickets. Our cast is completely vaccinated, so that's really great too with the nature of the show. There's a lot of scenes that are very intimate, so that's a that's something that we had to make sure that the cast was protected as well. We also have HEPA filter, and we cleaned the auditorium. So we're taking all protocols to make sure the audience feels as safe as possible as they come into our theater.
Michael, is there still room in the summer camp, or is that all filled up?
I believe there's just a little bit of room left in the summer camp, but it's filling up very fast. Lisa, who's our educational director, is really does these really great summer camps in the summer, and they fill up pretty fast. I think we have a little bit of room left, but not much.
You know, tell us about is the mural finally done? I know they were working on the mural in the lobby.
Yes. And the lobby is still a little bit of a work in progress, but the mural is done. It looks beautiful. Jesse Howe did a great work on it. We have a little bit more work to do with just putting up some TVs and some interactive things that we're doing for that, to allow for people to step out. They can see the auditorium, and also to do some ads and displays as well. For future shows.
Now, you have some cast members that I'm familiar with, some of the people from Munster Theater Company that are part of that. And tell us a little bit about some of the cast members you have.
Oh, the cast is great. We have Peyton Tinder, who's our Veronica Sawyer. Tyler Mills is our JD. The Heathers are Michaela McGroll. I'm horrible with last names, so I do apologize. Heather Duke is Mara Mazowski, and then Heather McNamara is Madison Marsh. And then also Martha Dunstock is Aaron Sharp, who was the director of our last show, James and the Giant Peach. So it's a great cast. These are people that I've worked with on several other shows as well, some new people as well. We had a virtual audition last year when we originally wanted to do it, and we had about 75 people audition virtually, and we had to whittle it down to our cast of 18. So that was really great to have this outstanding group of people. Now, again, we had some people who had to drop out for this year, but majority of them, only 4 people dropped out, and the majority of the cast came back for the second year, which is great.
Excellent.
And tickets are on sale right now, so you can get them. And of course, it's going to be opening this week. They'll be hearing this broadcast on the 11th. It's the opening. So it's June 11th through 27th. Tell us websites, Facebook pages, and where you're located.
Of course. The website is chicagostreet.org. That's where you can get all the ticket information. And then you can also find us on Facebook. The Facebook page is facebook.com/Chicago Street. And that's where you get all the ticket information, all the information about upcoming shows as well. And we're located right in downtown Valparaiso.
154 West Chicago Street. So that's, yes, Heathers the Musical, Chicago Street Theater. And they'll be opening June 11th through the 27th. Michael Glorioso, the director, thank you so much for being on Art of the Year Spotlight.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air, he has 40 years of experience in the newspaper management business. He's earned a reputation of producing quality newspapers and increasing the profits. He's known by his peers as Mr. Revenue, been an innovator producing out-of-the-box revenue for ideas for newspapers, won over 60 national state awards for his promotion, revenue ideas, and has brought to life many newspapers around the state of Indiana and beyond, and especially now with the Chesterton Tribune. Please welcome to Art in the Air, Don Hurd.
I'd like to meet that guy, whoever he is.
Welcome, the creator of local stars.
he's got a solid background there. Thank you for that interview, or the introduction. I appreciate that very much.
Well, Don, we'd like our audience would first of all like to know a little bit about you, like where you grew up, and I would like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Okay, well, as the old Beatles song, the Long Winding Road, okay, I grew up around Warsaw, Indiana, or more specifically, Mentone, Indiana. It's called the Egg Basket of the Midwest. And if you go downtown Mentone, you're going to find a 10-foot-tall concrete egg that has written on there, Egg Basket of the Midwest. There are so many egg farms around Mentone, Indiana, and it's just a nice, you know, rural country Indiana Hoosier town, you know, with a lot of kids in the summertime. All we did was bale hay or shuck corn and those type of things. So we learned, you know, from not to be afraid of hard work. And so I grew up in that area there, and then went to high school at Mentone High School, and we were called the Bulldogs, and That was like, I love the small community high schools. I just really loved that a lot. And then and eventually we graduated. Our two schools consolidated from Mentone to with Akron, Indiana, and into Tippecanoe Valley High School. And so we went to school there at Tippecanoe Valley our final year, and they were the Vikings. And I was the very first Viking mascot. I wore I wore a fake fur outfit on the basketball court and really hammed it up. But I loved that, you know.
What were the school colors?
Gold and green. Gold and green, yes. And that it was a great time, you know, to be the school mascot and just have a great time breaking in that new school. It was fun. Then from there, I went to Ball State University and got my degree in telecommunications and marketing and journalism. And Ball State is known to be a great journalism school here in Indiana. So I've got some good background with that and just really enjoyed the experience I had at college. And it was fun. Now, my very first job, you know, in the newspapering was when I was 11 years old. I carried papers for the Times Union newspaper in Warsaw. I had 43 customers, and I lived out in the country at that time. So I had to ride my bike after school, you know, out in the country. And I got to see a lot of neat things in the country. I had a lot of dogs chase me, you know, while I was while I was delivering my papers. But again, it was a fun experience. So I guess my roots are really deep rooted in the newspapers when I started at 11 years old.
Did you write for the school papers at all in high school?
Yes, I did. In junior high, some friends and I, we started an underground newspaper, and we sold it for 5 cents to kids on lunch break and things. And we wrote about a lot of satirical type things, kind of like a Mad Magazine or whatever. But it was really localized with some of the. It was actually called Talma Junior High, and back in 1974. That's when the tornadoes came through Indiana, and the Talma school was destroyed during that tornado. But when I was in there, junior high, we started an underground newspaper, and then from there went to high school, and I was editor of the high school newspaper. It was called the high school paper was called the Bulldog or Bulldette or something along that line. Then Tippecanoe Valley went to is called the Runic Review.
And wow.
Runic is the Viking word for newspaper or something along that line, and that's what they call it, the Runic Review. I was editor of that paper there at Tippecanoe High School, and that was fun. So again, I've got a long history, you know, being in newspapers and covering events and those type of things, and just kind of stuck with me. So I've got ink in my veins, and here I am today, you know. In my early 60s and still a paper boy.
Yeah. Well, you've been doing a lot. You work for Howard Publications, which, of course, I think one time did the Times up here. But what other types of places did you go after you got out of college?
Well, I've had, you know, think about, you know, being able to work at other companies, you know, it's allowed me to, you know, take some of their good practices and discard some of their bad practices as I come along in my career. And, I've been at newspapers, you know, in Logansport, Indiana. That was my first really big job at a newspaper, was the Logansport Ferris Tribune. And again, they were part of Howard Publications, which was also the Hammond Times. They had that same group there. But as, you know, as time moved on, you know, a lot of these newspaper groups and things bought each other out, you know, that type of thing. And they consolidated or, you know, combined papers. And so I started my career at the Ferris Tribune in Logansport, and then from there I was ad director at a small newspaper in Monticello, Indiana, called the Herald Journal, and that worked very well for me and worked my way up to general manager and publisher, and it worked great. And then I had an opportunity from there. People saw what I was doing, had an opportunity to go up to Sturgis, Michigan, just across the border of in Indiana, about 2 miles, you know, from the Indiana border. And one of the first days I got there at Sturgis, you know, I was introducing myself and talking to the staff, and one of them come up to me and said, "Boy, you talk funny," because I was from Indiana. Evidently, they talk different in Michigan, even though it was only two miles across the border. But I was at Sturgis, Michigan for a while. Then again, got another opportunity to go to the Frankfurt Times in Frankfurt, Indiana. Then eventually an opportunity came along from a group of papers down in West Frankfort, Illinois, the community media group. And they had like 30 different newspapers in Indiana and Illinois. So I became president of that group. And I oversaw 30 newspapers in Indiana and Illinois. And that was a great job. I loved doing that. I traveled along to a lot of different communities and helped increase their profits and upgrade their local news coverage, and did a great job with that. And I was really happy. And the profits were turning around. The corporate people were very happy what we were doing. And that was great. You know, then, you know, being ordered in, but it was always on my list, on my bucket list, to have my own newspaper. So, you know, through my children, you know, got them out of high school and got in college. And then an opportunity became available for to buy a newspaper in Benton County, which is Fowler, Indiana. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, I've made millions of dollars for all these other companies that I've worked for. I kind of know what I can do. And so I have the talent and the skill sets, you know, it wasn't that scary. So anyway, I talked to the people who owned the paper there in Fowler, Indiana, and we made a deal. And lo and behold, we signed the papers and I became owner of my first newspaper was the Benton Review in Fowler, Indiana. And I thought, wow, I've achieved more of my dreams and crossed that off my bucket list, and great, you know, life's good. And then after I bought that paper, you know, some other people, some families, they were retiring or getting out of the business and made me some offers, you know, on buying their newspapers. So I bought another one, then I bought two more, and then bought another one, and just kind of exploded, kind of like rabbits multiplying, you know. So it right now, currently, I own 20 newspapers in Indiana. And
John, do you have a core staff that goes from paper to paper to get them started and to help develop that community to do it? Or how hands-on are you with each one?
You're talking to them. I'm very, very hands-on. I don't, you know, at least in the beginning, I'm very, very hands-on. I try to go into each market and talk to this new staff there and kind of give them, you know, some ideas on how I like things done. You know, it's our formula, how we do things, you know, in our communities. You know, we don't really have any secret sauce, you know. It's just we do the basics very well. And our franchise and all our communities is local names and local faces. And that's what people want to see in their local newspaper, you know. And you know, they can get world news, they can get, you know, national news, even state news someplace else, but there's some things on the local level they can't get anyplace else but in their local newspaper. And that's what we're all about, local names and local faces. And I call it, I should patent this or trademark this phrase, but I call it refrigerator journalism. You know, when I was growing up and played basketball, ran track, my mom and dad, you know, my picture or name would appear in the paper. They cut it out and post it right up on the refrigerator. You know, it's kind of like the first social posting, you know, with their refrigerator. And I know a lot of people still do that, or they make scrapbooks and those type of things. So that's what we're all about, you know, giving people the local news that they can't get anyplace else. And that's been a very, very successful formula for us. Now we do run, you know, very lean, you know, in all our properties. You know, we don't, you know, it's like any newspaper corporation or whatever. I mean, a lot of them have cut back, you know, some of the, you know, like the Northwest Times, they've cut back a lot of their staff, you know, on the Post and all, they've cut back their staff. But, you know, we were already ahead of that game. So we really try to keep things lean, you know, and keep our costs low. And that helps on the profit side, you know. So
no staff reporters, but you have like reporters at large that
we do have a
pool of reporters.
Each newspaper has like an editor, and then they have a stable of freelancers that they use a lot, you know, to cover a lot of local news. Or we'll use like some you know, parents will cover some you know, sports events for us, or take photos for us, you know. Which helps out a lot. And I like that a lot because it really engages more local people to be involved with their newspaper. And it gives them a sense of ownership in being a part of the local newspaper. And so it's kind of a win-win situation for everybody by getting more local people involved with their local newspaper. And again, you know, a lot of newspapers have faltered and some have closed, you know, and it really pains me when I hear of a newspaper that's closed, because I know it can be saved if you just really change the times and do some things differently. You know, another newspaper that I bought was down in Clinton, Indiana, and it had been run by the same family for decades down there. But they just weren't willing to change with the times and upgrade things and do things differently. You know, but I know people kind of run out of gas, you know, but again, I have an abundance amount of energy, you know, that I love what I do. That's the main thing. I love what I do. It's not a job to me. You know, I always tell people, I go to a lot of classes and speak to students about career paths and things along that line. And I say, you know, money's great. It's nice. It helps pay for things, you know, but do what you enjoy doing, you know, have a passion, you know, and a lot of kids, 4-year colleges is not the way to go for them, you know. Get a skill set. You know, a lot of kids, you know, be a plumber or be a mechanic or be a beautician, be an HVAC person. I mean, those type of people, those type of skills are in great, great demand nowadays, and they can make a ton of money right out of trade school, you know. But some kids who go to college, you know, they struggle. A lot of them end up, you know, just temporarily find something in their field, and they may be, working at Walmart or wherever just to make a living, you know. But do something that's a passion. You know, if you wake up every morning and dread, and you go, another work day. You know, if you're doing that, you're in the wrong job. You're in the wrong job. You need to do something that when you wake up in the morning, you feel refreshed and energized, and you want to get out the door and hit the streets, you know, with what you're doing. Now, you know, and I'm not Superman, you know, but, you know, I do have my bad day. Who doesn't have bad days, you know? You know, ask anybody, you know, but on the majority, no, I love what I do. It's a passion of mine, you know, and I don't see myself ever, ever retiring, because I love what I do, you know, and I try to, you know, relay that, you know, to my employees, you know, the passion that I have, you know, and I talk to them about, you know, take ownership in what you do, you know, whether you're a pressman, whether you're a delivery person, or whether you're a graphic designer, or whether you're a salesperson, or you're working the business office, your name is on that paper. You represent that paper one way or another. So take ownership and take pride in what you're doing, and walk down the street, you know, because when you're out and about, you know, in local communities, people know you as you represent the newspaper. So be proud of what you do. You don't want to be walking around hanging your head, you know. So, but again, all our newspapers, you know, I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud of the staffs that we have. I've been very, very blessed to have the amount of people with the dedication they have, you know, and the commitment that they have to their profession. I have over the employees, I have over 60 employees that I have on staff. And if you combine all the experience that they all have in the newspapers, it's well over 500 years of newspapering experience that I have with the people that I have. And that shows they're all committed, you know, and they know what newspaper is all about. You know, they live in the communities, they represent the communities that they serve. And hopefully, you know, that they enjoy working for our company, you know, and being a part of something big. And, you know, newspapers, you know, they're the cheerleader for the community. They're the historian of the community. They're the watchdog of the community. And we try to do that very well in all the communities that we serve. We have some small communities, and we have, you know, some larger communities that we serve. And all of them use the same formula. It's the local names, local faces. And, you know, that's our franchise. And we're going to do everything we can to protect that franchise. Again, I'm not afraid using other platforms. You know, we're online, we're on Facebook, and we do other public events and things along that line. But it's all about building your brand and building that trust between you and the community and your readers, so they know you as the information leader. And anytime you want to stop me, because I can go on for a half hour. Or
well,
more.
You know, it's true though. A good product will generate a dedicated following, and that's what you're doing. I love the phrase that you use, hyper local. I mean, it kind of says it all. It's a really a wonderful phrase. It's an excellent phrase.
You know, if you find your passion, you don't work a day in your life, as the old saying goes. So, Don, I was going to ask you, have you explored, I mean, you talked about social media, but like other type of media, have you broadcasting or you ever venture into anything like that?
Right. We do special events, you know, in some of our communities, and we'll sponsor like, you know, some cooking shows, those type of things. You know, my degree is in telecommunications and radio, and I have looked at buying some other radio stations, okay, to complement what we do, okay. And I'm not saying that it's not going to happen, okay, but I don't want to let the cat out of the bag on anything, but I'm always looking for opportunities to build our brand as information leaders, you know. And again, you got to use several different platforms, whether it be print, whether it be online, whether it be social media, whether it be broadcast, you know, you build your brand, you know, so people trust you and see you as the information leader, you know, for their community. And that's, you know, we're always looking for opportunities. We do a lot of specialty magazines, you know, that we do in communities. So we'll do travel guides. We do farming magazines. We do, senior citizen guides, those type of things. So we look for niche products. You know, we do business journals, you know, in different communities, you know. So we look for niche products, you know, that may not be served within the community. So we do that with special publications. So that's another arm of our organization. And plus we do commercial printing too. You know, we got a commercial printing, a full-fledged commercial printing plant, you know, in Wabash, and a lot of our salespeople or account executives they have in all our other sites, you know, they can sell commercial printing, you know, do business cards, letterhead, you know, we can do direct mail campaigns for organizations. We can do it all. We're kind of a one-stop shop for any marketing need that a local business would need. And we can do it, you know, with local people you know and trust. And it's just kind of a win-win situation for everybody involved.
Do you keep the historic names of the newspapers or do you change them?
Pretty much. I actually, in the 20 that I've bought, we've never changed the name of the paper. We may have dropped the V on it or something along that line, but we keep the names. Yeah, we keep, because again, you know, a lot of these papers have a long, long tradition, you know, within the communities that they serve, you know, just like, you know, like Chesterton, you know, it's been almost 160 some years, you know,
right.
You know, so all my newspapers are legacies within the communities that they serve. You know, some of them back in the day may have combined, like you may have a Democrat and a Republican publication. Then all of a sudden, you got the Herald Journal, okay, or the Times Union, something along that line. So they were two separate papers at one time, but currently right now, and we don't try to be political in our coverage, okay? It's our job to tell the facts about a particular story, event, or whoever's running for political office, and then let the readers decide what side of the fence they want to fall on. You know, we don't sway it one way or another. That's, to me, that's not our job. To me, that's not the local media's job to do. And I know a lot of national media do it one way or another, but we don't do that. We try to tell the facts and educate the readers with the facts so they can make an intelligent decision on what side of the fence they want to fall on.
What specifically brought you to Chesterton for the Chesterton Tribune? How did you discover that and some of the decision making about doing that?
I used to be on the Hoosier State Press Board for 16, 17 years and have some really good friends down there. And the executive director, Steve Key, he sent me an email and he received something from the Canwright family and said they were thinking about maybe closing their paper. And did he know anybody who may be interested in purchasing the paper there? And so Steve immediately knew I was always in the acquisition mode for newspapers in Indiana. So he sent me an email and gave me some contact information about the Chesterton Tribune. So I immediately reached out, you know, to the Canwright family, but never heard anything back. You know, I know they were busy, you know, they're in their transition and things, but eventually, you know, I got an email through the Canwright family and got the response back. And then we were able to, you know, once I met with them and toured the facility myself and, you know, within 36 hours, we had the deal done. You know, I toured the community. It's a great community, Chesterton is. You know,
it's really sweet.
It's got a lot of things happening there, and it's still continuing to grow. So I can't imagine that type of a community, you know, being without a local newspaper. And the school corporation, the Duneland School Corporation, is huge. Oh my gosh, I saw it on one of the maps we have, and that is a large school corporation.
It is.
And again, you know, they're getting ready to go through their $100 million, you know, renovation product or the building project, you know, and that, you know, that's a lot of money, and the community needs to know how that money is going to be spent, you know, there in the Dewland Corporation, you know. And again, Porter County, it's a huge county too, you know. So, so that not to have a newspaper in Chesterton, you know, that would have been a real travesty, you know, to the local community, not having a local voice, you know. So we, you know, so I just made the deal, and here we are, you know. So,
so you have an extensive list of interests, and I'm particularly, are you a collector of photographs, or do you take photographs? And
I take photographs, but I like a lot of memorabilia type things, retro type things like that. I have a huge collection of antique Coca-Cola items. I've got like three antique Coca-Cola machines. I got, I don't know how many antique Coca-Cola Santa Clauses I have, the stand-up cardboard ones, and I got a huge collection of that stuff, you know, or some people call it dust collectors, you know, but I just love the old retro Coca-Cola themes that they had back in the day. Yeah, I take photographs. I also collect famous people's autographs. I got probably a couple hundred famous people's autographs, you know, that I have.
Do you get them personally, or do you?
A lot of them I've gotten personally. Yes, I've been very blessed to be able to go to different meetings and conventions, things along that line that that they've been at and been speakers at. So I've been very fortunate to be able to go to those type of things. And for the, I got Orville Redenbacher's. I met him personally, and that was always fun. But it's just fun to do. I got a wide variety of interests that I like to do with things, and I'm very heavily involved with Indiana Beach down in Monticello, Indiana. I was director of advertising for a few years there, and that was a great job. That's kind of one of my happy places I like to go to, and I guess I'm kind of a carny at heart, you know, when it comes to that. But it's just a fun place to go. And now, since the new owners at Indiana Beach is back to being family owned, which is wonderful. And I was the one that broke the story about Gene Staples buying Indiana Beach. And he spoke only to me, you know, the kind of story on that. I found out an email to contact him, and I emailed him a couple of times, never got anything back from him. Then one Saturday night, about 10:30 at night, I got an email from him, said, "Yes, I bought Indiana Beach, and I want you to break the story." And we've been friends ever since then. So it's been great. And then this year, again, call me crazy, but I am also a vendor at Indiana Beach this year, too. I have a gift shop at Indiana Beach, which is kind of fun. And so I'm doing that now, too. So I got a lot of irons in the fire. But again, I have a lot of energy. I got a lot of great people that work for me. And it allows me to go out and do some of these things that I enjoy.
Well, Don, we thank you for sharing your story and, of course, for revitalizing the Chesterton Tribune here in Porter County. That's Don Hurd, who's 40 years of experience in newspaper management, has brought the Chesterton Tribune back to life, and we really appreciate this in-depth interview with you on Art on the Air. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for Art on the Air, and you do a great thing in providing this news coverage, you know, for her local community. And again, I appreciate the opportunity, and go Chesterton Trojans.
Yay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And next on Art of the Year, we have Laura Fosberg. She is the exhibitions director for Lebesnik Center for the Arts, Chicago-based artist, and she's actually been exhibited nationally, internationally. Her focus is on painting, printmaking, and such, and she's going to be talking about upcoming exhibits. We also have Phyllis Bramson, an American artist based in Chicago, known for the richly ornamental and excessive decadent paintings, described as walking a tightrope between edginess and eroticism. Both of you, welcome to Art on the Air.
Aloha, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Laura, let's start with you. Just a little bit about your history, how you got from where you were, where you grew up, where you studied, and what brought you to Lebesnik as the exhibition director.
Sure. Well, I started as a young budding artist at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I got my bachelor's degree there in 1988. And then I went on to the School of the Art Institute to get my master's degree in painting and printmaking, and I finished in 1992. I have been an exhibiting artist ever since, and as you said, have shown all over the place. And I continue to make artwork. Right now, I'm really interested in ceramics, but I'm mostly a painter and a printmaker, and I dabble in sculpture as well. I lived in Chicago for 35 years, a really long time, and had a big loft in Wicker Park during the heyday of Wicker Park in Bucktown. And eventually, I lost my gigantic 3,500 square foot loft to gentrification. And all that time, I had a little cabin in Michigan City that was, you know, the fun time house. And it was summertime fun time. And I love it over here on this side of the lake. It's so beautiful with the natural environment being preeminent. And I'm a tree hugger, so I really had to have a place to get away. And I never thought I would live here. But after I lost my loft and I moved here permanently, I really took a look around and, you know, fell deeper and deeper in love with Michigan City and the region and its mix of eclectic people and artists and every kind of community that exists here. And I was great friends with Carol Ann Brown, who was the director of exhibition or the curator before me. And at one point she was having some health issues and it was time for her to step away from the job. And I kind of came in an emergency situation to help shore up the shows that were upcoming. One of which was a Warhol show, which was a really big deal for the Lubeznik Center. That was three summers ago. And here I am still curating and creating shows for our center. I have always felt like this place was sort of under-recognized and underutilized. And I feel like it can really grow and conquer. The exhibition space is world-class. And I feel like it could be a little mini Walker Center for the Arts, which is in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and has now become world renowned. It started off just like this, a nonprofit center that was showing regional artists and turned into an international phenomena. And I feel like the Lubeznik Center can do that too, to some degree, if that's what we want. What I really want is to bring incredible artists. In the past, we mostly showed regional artists. And to be honest, we continue to do so. Lots of artists from Chicago and around the Midwest. But I'm really interested in showing really established artists who have gotten a lot of recognition, mixed in with artists who have yet to receive recognition. So I want to create a draw to people who know about the art world and they want to come see Phyllis Bramson. And, you know, she's a renowned Chicago artist who's been making art for 40 years or more. And she has a big name. And I know she'll be a big draw. But then they'll see Mayumi Lake's work. And they'll discover a new artist who hasn't quite received the accolades like Phyllis has yet. So I really enjoy this mix of bringing different artists together. And my main focus is to represent what's happening in the now. So as a curator, I feel that artists are sort of the canary in the coal mine. You know, when you study art history, you're really studying world history. And that's because the artists are the man on the street and they're exploring what's happening in the moment and recording those ideas. And so I'm really interested in what's happening right now. And I try to bring shows like that to our community so people can have another way of understanding history. It's not just written history. It's also a visual history through the arts. And I'm dedicated to bringing that. In the club now, we have Theaster Gates and Gertrude Abercrombie, who are really well-established artists and really important in our region. And of course, our next show, our big summer blockbuster is Phyllis Bramson, Robert Indiana, and Mayumi Lake.
Well, you know, speaking of history, I would like to just travel back in yours. So what was Laura like as an elementary school student? So when did you start? I mean, what are your first memories of like falling in love with art?
Well, my mom owned a print shop. a litho printing commercial print shop. So we always had pounds and pounds of paper. And with the scrap paper, my mom would make me pads of paper. And boy, I would just sit there and fill up those pads of paper with drawings. I would fill the whole pad, no matter how thick she made the pad. So what
were you drawing, Laura? What were you drawing from life? Were you drawing abstract?
No, I was taking lessons from a local artist, and she had these files filled with cutouts from every kind of magazine from every era. And so she'd say, go through the files and pick what you are interested in, whether it be like African safari animals or palaces in Europe or whatever you could think of. So my world was open and I was drawing everything, but it was almost all in a cartoon sort of animated sort of style, which I continue to do today.
Very good. Well, now you're having several artists there and you've not mentioned them, but one of them is Phyllis Bramson. So Phyllis, let's move on to you. You're going to be exhibiting there and we'll get the dates and everything later in the show. But one of the things I've read about your description is you have a ornate sense of the spectacle. You use a theatrical use of pattern, decorative elements. And so tell us a little bit about your journey, your biography, how you got from where you were to where you are. And let's explore your work.
Well, that has a certain significance in terms of some of the things that I am currently doing that don't quite fit into the current notion of what artists should be making. But the reason that I have the visual interest in certain things is because when I was growing up, it was a time when many, many households had Asian influences. So there'd be, you know, Asian furniture, pictures on the wall. In my house, there was, in the dining room, there was Asian wallpaper, very odd gray and mauve colored, and filled the whole dining room. And I was always looking at that. Then all over the house, particularly in the living room, were statuettes of women. Again, Asian types of women, often half-clothed, arms in the air in a provocative pose. Also Asian scenic pictures, just everything Asian. Then added to that, which once I mention it, it almost slams too directly, is that my father was an auto parts salesman. He was a wholesaler. And because of that, at Christmas time, he would bring home boxes and boxes of greeting cards. And I had a younger sister, and we would sit in our living room looking through the boxes, trading, bartering. And of course, being older, I was a little more sly about that. But many of the greeting cards were absolutely exquisite with glitter. And I mean, we're talking about in the 40s, late 40s. And so elaborate. And then there were the girly calendars. And then there were the pencils and the cups, objects that if you turned them upside down, they were nude. So I was handling both lasciviousness and beauty at the same time. So I think those three elements have really informed my visual interests. And in fact, I was telling Laura that when I teach, I always ask the grad student, what were the first memories you had? What did you look at first? Where does this, Laura was explaining, where does your visual notions come from? Because I don't think I think those first interests are really important, meaning our childhood is really important, travels with us, unless somebody is absolutely trying to get rid of all of that. And then they work totally abstract, not objectively, nothing maybe that they're saying in particular, but dealing with formal issues.
It's really true, because as I look through my extensive art career, I'm still attracted and still expanding on what I was doing in high school. All the things that, you know, it's more, it's like, it's got a layer of sophistication now that I didn't have when I was a teenager, but it's, I'm still learning and I'm still working kind of in the same style, but expanded. So yes, that childhood stuff is very important.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
You know, the funny thing is, and when I was in undergrad and grad school, I just kind of worked. Nobody really talked to me much about what I was doing. The notion of, you know, what happened when one was in school. I've kind of lost my train of thought about what you were saying, though.
Just the things that I loved, the direction of my art has expanded, but it's really all the same. I'm still working. I'm taking the stuff from high school and expanding it now. You know, I'm still excited by it.
So sometimes I'll ask students to tell me what they collected when they were younger, what they collect now, and if they were curating a show, who would they choose? What would they put on that wall? How would it look?
Well, how would you answer that? What did you collect? What are you collecting?
Well, if you were to come into my studio, it's all about the figure, mostly heads, masks. The work that I collected in my studio, on my walls, and even at home, and the way it's set up is exactly how I work, and it's always curated. And so I think many, many people curate their homes, and my husband always criticizes me sometimes that there's too much. And the funny thing is, probably just like in my work, if I add something and it's not working, I almost feel sick to my stomach until I remove it. Mm-hmm. Or like the things that I'm making in the studio, I do a lot of collaging, and so they're on in a temporary manner. They're spray glued on so I can take them off. And every once in a while, I'll walk into the studio and something's fallen off, and I'll say, "You're right." Both know this, you know, that your work talks to you. You're the first audience that sees the work.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I have that physical reaction too. It is like a physical thing that, okay, this is not right. And then immense joy too, when you're like, you just know when it's just flowing properly.
Right.
Is it like that for you, Laura?
So much so, yes. I usually work on multiple pieces at the same time. And I have to do that because I have to let a piece rest because I know it's not right, but I don't know how to fix it. And so it just has to sit over there by itself and figure itself out. And then I'll, just like Phyllis, I'll walk in and I'll say, "Oh, that's what's wrong with it." And then I can, but it does take time. There's no doubt about it. You can't rush a good thing.
I know in photography, a lot of times what I do is I go out and I shoot certain things. And then they stay in the can. I keep them on the file. And then I come back and revisit them with a whole new vision of like, oh, yeah, that was good. Now I know where to go with that. And, you know, nothing I shoot comes straight on the camera onto what it is. It's all processed and everything. Phyllis, I was going to ask you a little bit. You mentioned teaching. Where are you teaching at?
I'm at the School of the Art Institute.
Okay.
I'm a visiting artist. So I just work with graduate students. I've been a long time faculty member. I used to be at the University of Illinois in Chicago until I decided to leave.
Excellent. Laura, I have a question of balancing act. You, as a practicing artist yourself, but also doing curating for exhibits, that's got to be kind of an interesting balance to do. I mean, you know, they are related. It's much like what I had to do as a facility manager for theater and also directing shows. So tell us about how you balance that out for yourself.
Can I add to Larry's question? And can you tell me how this intense period of curating, so focused curating, how has it changed you and maybe your art or how you see art?
Yeah, you know, they're all part of one question, really, because you know, as an artist, I never really considered curating. I never considered it an art form. I never considered it a mode of expression, to be honest. You know, I don't know what I was thinking, but I'm a self-centered artist. So I was thinking about art and not curatorial aspects of how shows are put together. And now curating, you know, it's really fun to pick and choose and be able to be the arbiter of taste. It has informed my work greatly. Now I have access to artists that normally I would just be looking at online and I would go see their shows in galleries, but I really wouldn't have so much reason to sit down and talk with them or chat or, you know, investigate their work more deeply. And I will say that my curation is all about my taste. I mean, it's really about what I'm interested in. And then I just try to make sure that it fits in with our mission at the Lubeznik, which is accessibility, accessibility, accessibility. I want to be able to talk to every kind of person, but that's really interesting because that's how I approach my own artwork. So since I was a youngster just out of school, this tells how old I am, but I always said, I want the guy who pumps the gas at the gas station to understand the work. I don't want it to be austere or inaccessible. I want him to get it. So my approach to curating is exactly the same. I really want you to get it. Now, you might have to work a little bit towards it, but I'm not terribly interested in showing work that makes the viewer feel stupid. Every piece has to have an entry point for every kind of person. So it has informed my work, and getting to meet important artists and unimportant artists alike, they're all the same to me. They're all practicing their trade and all talented in their own right. And it's just a thrill to be able to have sort of a life that I had in grad school, where you're constantly meeting with artists and professionals in your field and rubbing shoulders with all kinds of people. And as an artist, I mostly just do that at art openings and through fundraisers and things like that. And now I have another way to do it. So it's very exciting and very fulfilling.
And I have to say, your the talks that you give relating to the exhibits are so full and rich and so enjoyable. And you are a big key to that accessibility to the art. I mean, I've enjoyed all the ones I've attended.
Well, I really appreciate that. And just for all of our listeners, I give gallery talks for free. So anytime you want a gallery talk, you call the institution and we'll set it up. You can bring your yoga group. You can bring your best friends. You can bring your family. Of course, because of COVID, we're sort of restricting still. That should be changing soon. But at the moment, I'd like to keep the gallery talks to 15 people or under. And we are still wearing masks in our institution. But yeah, free gallery talks anytime you like, for the most part.
Oh my gosh, everybody take her up on that. They're fabulous.
Well, it's been really great during COVID because, you know, it was very difficult to have visitors, and visitors didn't really want to come because they were afraid. So we organized gallery talks two, three times a week for different groups, sometimes even more. And it's a different experience than just going to see a show. To have me walk you through the show and tell you the reasons why the pieces are in the show and what I think it's all about, it, and how it relates to you, is a much more intimate way to view artwork. And it's really exciting for the participants. Everybody always claps at the end, which I think is hilarious. But it does tell me that they were really engaged. And also, because we're all standing there looking at each other, I can tell when they get bored, and so I can speed up and I can slow down and I can move faster or move slower. And it's really, really fun and a great way to connect with our audience.
You know, in this upcoming exhibit, you have some other artists. Tell us briefly about them.
Sure. Robert Indiana, you guys probably know, he's very famous for his sculpture titled Love that sits in front of many major institutions like the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And he was an artist in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and passed recently, but most people don't know that he made some fairly controversial artwork back in the 60s and 70s and was responding to civil rights issues. And because we're sort of having that moment again, I thought it'd be really interesting to explore his work. So I borrowed from the Midwest Museum of American Art in Elkhart, Indiana, and I borrowed from the South Bend Museum of Art, and we're bringing in some prints that he made that are graphically amazing and stunning to look at, but they also have very deep meaning. So I'll be really excited to share that with you. And then we also have Mayumi Lake, who is a Japanese American artist, and she will be filling our installation gallery with an installation responding to the moment. So I'll be very excited for you to see all three of these really visually dynamic artists.
Can everybody get in touch with you?
You can reach us anytime through our website, thelubesnickcenter.org. You can call, you can Facebook, you can Instagram and reach out, and we will reach back.
Excellent. Phyllis, what is your website and how can people find you?
I just wanted to say that you don't want them knocking at your door. my website is phyllisbramson.com, and also I have an Instagram.
I think it's Phyllis Bramson. It's at Phyllis Bramson, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what it is, yeah.
If I could just mention, we'll have a gallery talk July 10th at 11:30 a.m., and it's free.
Well, we appreciate you being on Art in the Air. That's Laura Fosberg, the Exhibitions Director for Lubesnick Center for Arts, talking about the upcoming show that they're having there, which will open June 14th and running through October 15th. And Phyllis Bramson is one of the artists that will be in that show. We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your stories and your work.
Completely wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Art in the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art in the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art in the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. Plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art in the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art in the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. Information about Art in the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself.